All right, welcome back. So I'm going to offer a short kind of recap and maybe reworking of last week's talk around contact and how that creates the sense of our world or our reality. Now, this week, at one point, my family and I, my daughter and my wife, were sitting watching a sitcom with a kind of a family dynamic, a family that was living together. And at one point, they thought the 20-some daughter was pregnant, but she really wasn't. And so at one point, the father's having this heart-to-heart felt conversation with this woman, saying how they're going to support her and how hard it's going to be, but you know, how much money it's going to cost, but the family's really behind her. Well, the daughter's having a completely different conversation, thinking that they're actually talking about her decision to go back to school and to college and the uncertainty of that. And they're having these parallel conversations about something completely different. And at the end, after the young lady leaves, the father realizes that she really isn't pregnant. And he wonders, what were we talking about? And this is such a common, you know, motif in media, to see how we have these mistaken understandings of what's going on. Remember once my wife and I, it's been years ago, so I forget what the conversation or conflict was around, but it was an argument that we both felt very triggered around. And we spent time listening to each other, really deeply listening beyond our conditioning, beyond our assumptions, to really hear the other person. And even though the exact same incidents, we had a completely different way of interpreting it, a different way of feeling hurt. And once we figured that out, we were able to come back to that point of contact. So the Buddha talked about this world creation in some way of a, I don't know, obscure way or a mysterious way, that he said that the world is created in this phantom long body with its perceptions, its imaginings. That's what the world is created from and contained in, these six senses of our normal five and the sense of the mind. And we use that to create our assumptions of the world, the description of how the world is. And so often that description doesn't really match reality. We create our reality through our prehistory, our memories, and this is what the previous links of dependent origination have focused on, is seeing how that is created, how that's developed through our history, through our energy and our actions. Last week, I told a story from 1930 of a man named William Huskinson, who was a British Parliament in Liverpool, and he was attending an opening of a railway. And so thinking back to 1830, a railway was an unusual event, an unusual thing outside of people's experience. And he actually got run over by the train. He looked at the train and said, okay, it's that far away. Judging by how fast horse-drawn carts move, I have plenty of time. But he had no idea of how fast a locomotive could move. And I tell this story because sometimes reality, when we've misunderstood it, runs us over, sometimes literally, sometimes figuratively. We have this misassumption, misconnection of how things actually are. And one way to summarize our practice as Dharma students is learning how to drop and see through that assumption, to see through that projection that we place on the world, to clear the dust from our eyes, to actually make contact with what actually is. And in the meditation, we focused on that sense of what is the actual contact of this moment without adding anything to. That's easily said. And of course, when we set that intention not to add anything to something, we see how much we actually are adding to it. I was talking to my wife after last week's talk, and she was just noticing, looking around this room we're practicing in, and how all these memories, all these thoughts would come up, all these associations with simply seeing something like the wall or something like a TV, and realizing, wow, there's this added on element that we put to reality. But that literally becomes the way our world in that moment becomes, how we view the world, and more importantly, how we act from the world. And everything else that's contrary to that is disregarded, is ignored, or reinterpreted to match our projection, to project how we actually see life. There's a dramatic story that I sometimes tell in my intro classes. This was, I found this in a book that was referencing a 1936 journal of psychology, I believe. It was called Scared to Death. It was about a young man, a healthy man, who was in prison on death row and was sentenced to die. And a physician somehow convinced him to do this experiment. He said, okay, well, you're going to be hung, but instead of that, let's do this other way of executing you, and let's have you be bled to death. It would be gradual, be painless, and maybe a better deal. Of course, the physician wasn't going to really do that, was just doing a psychological experiment. So this young man was strapped down, and they scratched his four limbs without really breaking the surface, but had water dripping down into these pails on each side. And gradually it became slower and slower. And the physician spoke softer and softer until finally the young man had seemed to have passed out. But actually he had died just through his imagination, through his reinterpretation of those points of contact, of the drip of the water, reinterpreting that as his blood leaving his body. So I am trying to just emphasize how significant this reinterpretation is into our world, and how the practice brings a profound way to interrupt that, to see through that, to connect with life how it actually is. This applies to all aspects of our life, how we hold ourselves in relationship, how we hold ourselves with the people we love, with strangers. You know, the outcry over, you know, the needless death of Blacks through the hands of police, and the level of prejudice that is still a day-to-day experience. It's just an example of this deep projection, this deep way of reinterpreting reality based on our assumptions, and for very fatal and destructive traumatic effect. There is a book I've been reading that was around exploring this idea of why people survive in natural disasters and wilderness excursions, and other people don't, and what's the psychology behind that. And this author talked about how the survivor does not impose pre-existing patterns on new information, but rather is new information to reshape their mental models. This sums up coming back to bare attention, to not impose our pre-existing patterns, our assumptions, our sankharas, our history, our memories, our assumptions on the present moment's experience, but to actually see it directly for how it is. And yet this is such a strong, strong pattern. This is such a strong momentum. Another line from this book, it's a little dense, so I'll read it perhaps one or two times. And the author, Lawrence Gonzalez, said, "Everyone, to one degree or another, sees not the real world, but the ever-changing state of the self in an ever-changing invention of the world." So not seeing the real world, but the ever-changing state of who they are, the state of the self in an ever-changing invention of the world, how you're creating the world. This is the language of the Buddha. And we live in a continuous reinterpretation of sensory input and memories. We don't just hear something directly, purely. We hear our interpretation. We're literally hearing our mind through our senses. And from that, there's contained presets that any given moment can light up neural pathways of shifting kaleidoscope of energy, which we come to think of as reality. This is the point of contact that then creates this whole world of understanding of creation of the world. And again, we take the world and we shape it to our image of it, not how it actually is. This story I wrote, I talked about how this arises from interpersonal or to our own sense of us. And this is a beautiful example that Sharon Salzberg wrote about. She said that when I was teaching with my colleague, Joseph Goldstein, when a student came to see him in great distress, the man said he just had a terrible experience. He was meditating, felt tension in his jaw, and suddenly realized what an uptight person he is, how he can't get close to anyone, and that how that's going to be, he's going to be alone for the rest of his life. Joseph said, "You mean you feel some tension in your jaw?" The man continued with his projections. He said that he was pretty sure he'd always be tense. He would never change. He felt hopeless. "You mean you felt some tension in your jaw?" Joseph said. I watched the man continue barreling down this path of misery for some time, all because of a sore jaw, until finally Joseph said, "You're having a painful experience. Why are you adding a horrible self-image to it?" It's such a clear example of this adding to, and the painful, destructive ramifications of this. So can we be willing to see through our projections, our assumptions of how we take life to be? It's such a critical point of practice. And yet it's the whole point of practice, is how to come back to this very moment. Now contact, this, again, the very bare moment of just this bare sense of touch, of sight, of smell, of sound, of taste, or of thought. Just that very bare experience before we start to like it or dislike it, before we start to want it or not want it, even before we start to apply a label, "I know what this is." In that very bare moment of contact, that becomes like this breadcrumb trail that takes us back to the present moment. Just like Hansel and Gretel being taken into the woods and lost, finding that breadcrumb trail to find their way back to home. So we can use this point of contact to find our way back home to this present moment. What's actually here right now, right in this moment? Last week, I suggested three ways of working with contact to help it be this breadcrumb trail back into this present moment when we're lost. And the first one is to notice that sense of contact and what am I adding to it? What is being elaborated upon? You know, whether it's resistance, whether it's longing, whether it's craving, even a label. Is all things we can add to this moment. Learning to see what is the actual experience of the breath, the sense of the breath versus our thoughts of the breath. This is such a basic, essential teaching, and yet it's meant to not be a basic lesson. It's meant to take us into the depths of the Dharma to see how that added onness is really the seed of creating this sense of me, this sense of I. So I think it's helpful to always assume that we're adding something to this moment, that it takes a sense of stillness and tension, a quality of inquiry to see what we've added to this moment. And just like layers of an onion, slowly peeling those away to come back to that moment of contact. Now, when we do that, we have to be willing to release our opinions, our ideas, our views to make that bare contact. There's the classic story of the elephant with the seven blind men who would come and each would touch one part of the elephant and proclaim, "I know what an elephant is," based on this one contact. And the elephant is like, you know, the ear shape or the tusk shape or the tail. Or the the leg. And each one of them would say, no, you're wrong. This is what the elephant is like. This is all what's added to this moment. So it requires that innocence, that sense of non-opinionation to really connect with this actual moment's experience. This is why we emphasize the phrase coined by Suzuki Roshi of beginner's mind, as starting new, starting fresh. Even though I've felt this, my breath, a million times, can I feel it as though I've never felt it before? Can I meet my spouse of 40 years with a freshness? Can I meet myself with a freshness, with an innocence, with immediacy? Sometimes it's described, I think, with Suzuki Roshi, that people with a deep level of awakening often have this sense of being mildly surprised by life, because they're not applying this sense of assumption. There's this, what's here in this moment? There's this turning toward with not preconception, but freshness, with spontaneous, with direct intimacy. So asking, what am I adding to this moment? And practicing releasing to the best we can. Another way of practicing is to notice the other contact points which are available in this moment. So let's say there's a particular mind state that's very gripping, that's very strong. Calling your attention, direct your attention to something like sound or something like the breath in the body or the breeze touching your skin. This provides another contact point that helps to reorient you to this present moment. Instead of being lost in the past, the remorse of thought or the fear, anxiety of the future, it calls us back home, finding that breadcrumb trail back to our true home. And then finally, the third one I offered was to see state of mind which is holding this experience. This is in some ways asking us to go back to that consciousness, that level of what is the state of our attention, or as described in the third noble or third foundation of mindfulness, what is the mind state itself? Not with a sense of I shouldn't be agitated or I shouldn't be distracted, but noticing how that mind is. And then when you're feeling, I think we all know this, that when we're kind of grumpy, we tend to see things that reinforce the grumpiness. We tend to reinforce that mind state and things which support us, which are perhaps contrary to that mind state, are just disregarded, just ignored. So noticing the mind state and how that shapes the very way we perceive the world can be very helpful. This is this sense of stepping back to observe, to notice, to not be lost in this reactivity, in this mind storm. Learning to step outside and interrupt this process of suffering we call dependent origination. So the practice is literally learning to come back to the contact, to come back to the simplicity of that. The whole reason to do this is to see the emptiness that's inherent in all things. When I say emptiness, I'm not talking about the sense of absence of a void or in a kind of a negative way we often think of that, but to actually understand that everything is inherently empty of self. The Buddha described this in the Sunna Sutta, the empty sutta, when Venerable Anatta went to the Blessed One in arrival, asked him, it is said that the world is empty. The world is empty. In what respect is it said that the world is empty? And the Buddha said, it is empty of a self or anything pertaining to a self. Empty of a self, or of anything pertaining to a self. Empty of what the eye sees, what the mind thinks, what the nose smells. we tend to go into the process that I'm smelling, I'm feeling, I'm sensing. But this is all part of this illusion of selfing. This is the illusion that we're exploring independent origination. And coming back to that moment of contact, just this breath, just this sound, provides a refuge from this cycle of suffering. All right, let's just sit quietly for a few moments and letting those words settle. Thank you for your kind attention. So I want to frame this. I know some of you may jump off when I say the word discussion group. So just hang on for a second and hear the structure of this. So right now, I think I'd like to experiment with us doing some dyads. Now, some of you may not want to do dyads, and that's perfectly fine. So you have two options if you like to prefer not to. You could just not go into the group and just hang out, and we'll come back at 8:30 or 8:35 or so. Others, or you could jump off the call and come back about that time if you want to hear the questions and answers. And for the rest of us who would like to experiences the dyads. So dyads are a way of working with another person. It's really the way we often do it at SIMS, is a way of someone holding your sense of inquiry, learning how to direct your attention again and again on a simple question, a simple point of understanding to see how you help you deepen into that. Because often when we think of something, we try to inquire around it, our mind kind of skips out of it. Listen, takes the first answer, then gets bored. But our partner gently reminds us of this question, this point of inquiry. So if you do this sincerely, you often find there's this sense of dropping deeper and deeper into your understanding of this point of inquiry. So I've never done this on Zoom call, so please bear with me as we struggle through this. And I know there's also some of us are couples too. So I think I'll propose this, that the couple, those of you who are couples, don't go into the Zoom room, just stay by yourself, and you can continue, you can practice. Leave the sound on, and I'll tell you when we switch roles. The other ones, I'll assign you to a partner. Now, some of you may be by yourself for a moment till I can assign another person to you. So don't worry. Although that might be, we'll see what happens. I'm sure there will be some mistakes here. So the question we're going to have, we're whole, will be two questions. We'll do this for 5 minutes, and then we'll switch roles. What I'll do is I'll send a little broadcast to everyone saying, okay, now it's time to switch. So you can see that on your screen. The first question is, what are you adding to this moment? What are you adding to this moment? So when you go into the breakout room, decide who's going first. We'll call that person A, and second one is person B. And person A will ask the simple question, what are you adding to this room? What are you adding to this moment? What are you adding to this moment? And the other person will hear that question and then see what arises from that and offer that back to the silence. And your job in person A is not to add anything to it, not to ask follow-up questions, but simply ask the question again. So they would do this for 5 minutes, then we'll switch roles. I'll send a broadcast out and you switch roles. So person B will say, what are you adding to this moment? And person A will respond. And after that cycle of 5 minutes, we'll go to the second question, which is, what is here if nothing is added? And I'll send this out as a broadcast so you don't have to worry about remembering it. So person A will ask that question, person B will respond. So hopefully that's clearer than mud. I don't know. We'll see how that goes. sense of self that's constantly there, you know, it's, you know, first of all, just to realize that suddenly you're no longer as lost in it. There's a little bit of space. There's a little bit of perspective. And you might also notice that there's, it's probably not as universal or as seamless as it first seems. You know, for one, you can see how the different senses of self arise throughout the day, that there's sometimes you may feel more at peace and more at ease. And it has a certain manifestation of a sense of self, a certain way of being in the world. And then there's a time when you're more agitated or upset, and how that has a different set of streams of thought that come up. That's a different sense of self that has arisen. That way you start to see that illusion that self is continuous is actually like we're connecting the dots to make the picture. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's all these senses of self that arise and then fade. It just happens so quickly that we tend not to acknowledge the falling away. We tend not to acknowledge the fading because we're already busy acting out of that new sense of self. And you may also notice that there's times when that sense of you is much softer, is much quieter. You know, perhaps when you're just sitting peacefully without anything to do, you're just, you know, hanging out with your cat or looking at the beauty of nature. And there's just a sense of not having a lot between you and what's being experienced. There's not a sense of having to do something with. And notice how the sense of self in that time is much quieter, much softer, much thinner. And other times it becomes much thicker when we're much more engaged. I have a lot to do. I have to really get in there and change myself or change my circumstances.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Yeah, and then, you know, by doing that, then you start to become curious to, okay, where is this sense of self? It seems to be continuous. It seems to be omnipresent. And see, can I sense where that's located? Where does that reside? Is there a physical location that I can find? And if you can't find it, if it's something outside of thought, then you start to see through that.
Mm-hmm.
And when that falls away, every time it just spontaneously drops away, and there's like something is profoundly absent, and yet something is profoundly revealed in the same moment.
Thank you.
Thank you, Iris.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Kate Davis. You can unmute yourself. Yeah, there you go.
Hi, Tim. First, I just like to say I just love these questions. They are so juicy. they really get to the heart of the experience by pointing out what we're adding to it. And so I really appreciate the questions. I found that with my partner, for both questions at the beginning, I went a lot to noticing pleasant or unpleasant.
Yes.
But then gradually as the time went by that I was responding, there was less and less. There was the sense of self was thinning, to use what you just said to Iris. It was like getting less and less and less and quieter and quieter and quieter. And it was like, in the end, you know, it was like nothing. In both cases, it was like stillness, openness, spaciousness. Spaciousness. It was just, the experience was just the experience without a lot being added, without anything that I was consciously aware of being added.
Yes. Yeah. Beautiful. Yeah, I think that's what the intention of those dyads and those questions are, to first highlight what we add to the moment and see how that's really an optional thing, that we can let that relax. And you know, to quote Shakespeare, it's so much ado about nothing. You know, we create this whole world that we're reacting to and acting from. But if we start to be quiet and noticing what we add to this moment, it has this sense of subtraction, at the same time, a sense of emerging of what's actually here. It's like uncovering something that's been long forgotten and buried. And then I think an important reflection is to say, okay, which of those feels more true, more real, you know, more consistent? Because we so often take what's added on as being what's real. That's where, you know, the life has to, that's where I have to really engage. And yet when we come subtract everything, come back to what's not added in the moment, that's something that is pointing toward or an expression of what the Buddha would say is the deathless, yeah. Is the unconditioned.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that, Kate. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes, Katie.
Hi, I was actually with Kate. So that was really lovely. But yeah, it was really interesting. At first, the second question, I was a little, I think, apprehensive. I was like, what does that really mean? But once I got into it, it kind of clicked for me. And before Sims tonight, I got some news that was kind of irritating and that I was upset about. And then once I was going into this question, it just kind of all fell away. And I was like, this is not a big deal at all. And it kind of felt really relieving it just felt like kind of a stillness to not have to be adding all these stories in and these emotions and these feelings about it. And then eventually it just got quieter and quieter. And I don't know, it kind of felt like this sense of like death, like everything was kind of gone, but it felt, this might sound weird, but it felt really joyful. Like it was just like it was kind of a calming, relieving feeling. So yeah, it was all really unexpected, but really interesting exercise.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that, Katie. That's a nice description of that. That quality of letting go, you know, letting go of our story, because the story is really embedded in that sense of me, a sense of identity. And one thing that Rodney said years ago that I always, you know, found it an interesting thing to reflect on is that where is our problems if we're not thinking about them? You know, if not holding something in my mind, it's out there. I mean, there's a reality to it, but it's like we're rehearsing it, especially something in the future. We're thinking about anticipating. But if we let go of the story around the idea through something as simple as coming back to this point of contact and releasing what we're adding to it, then there's what's remains is a sense of peace, a sense of profound happiness that's not based on the conditions. And this is the happiness that the Buddha pointed toward. That, you know, he says this is a way to deeper and deeper happiness. His disciples were often remarked that they seemed very content and very happy, even though they were monks and nuns, had renounced everything in the world, all their possessions. And we can get a deep sense of this as we renounce, you know, the possessions of the mind, the possessions of our holding. And you experience that. You experience that sense of peace, that sense of joy that's outside of our thoughts. And there is a death. I mean, there is a sense of dying to our ego, to our sense of self. And yet that death isn't one of desolation. It's one of peace, of joy, and deep connection. So thank you, Katie.
Thank you.
Right. Anyone else like to share something? And if I don't see your hand, you can just unmute yourself. You can't see you all at once. Okay, Suzanne.
I love being the questioner so much more. because that felt like there wasn't that much ego, because all there was asking the question and like being present, ask question, present. And for the first question, what are you adding to this moment? I noticed, and my partner alluded to this too, is like, there's definitely the times when the ego is giving the right answer. Like the heady, like, ah, yes, it's this. Ah. And you trick yourself into thinking that that's something other than the ego feeling good about itself. And then you see you're doing it. And then you ask, then you hear the question. And then something just comes out that just comes out. And it's like there. And then you go into the, then it's like this switching back and like always. And oh God, the second question was just, I was just like, I don't know how to not add. What is here? Nothing is added. If it's coming out of my mouth, it's being added. It's like, I can't. So it was really hard for me to not, like, to the identity really wanted to do that right. And there's got to be something that I, so that was interesting. The first one, it's like, oh, I'm always adding. All right, let me just think of all the things I'm adding, all the things I'm adding. And the second one, I was just very much trying to do something and then finding peace for a little bit and then trying to do. And yeah, that's what it was. But it was, I'm a dyad fan. I'm all about intimacy. So bring on the dyads. Keep it up.
Great. Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
I've been, hesitant about using the dyads in the Zoom format, but I think it seemed to work pretty well based on what people are sharing. Yeah, the sense of the discernment of noticing, where am I speaking from in this moment? Am I speaking from that sense of wanting to impress, that sense of wanting to be, you know, seem important, and just noticing that, and then seeing when it comes from a different place, a place of the heart, for example. And that, you know, the practice is, it's so easy to say, okay, one is better than the other, but really what's important is the sense of seeing it. Is seeing, oh, this is where I come from in this mind place and this ego's place. And how does that feel? How does that relate to the sense of suffering? And versus that sense of coming from the heart and how that, the connection that you felt, that's so valuable, how that was present. So it's that sense of discernment, letting the beauty of mindfulness is just to see clearly. And in that seeing, we naturally start to orient away from suffering and toward freedom. And the second question, with that sense of, you know, it's hard to access what is here if nothing is added. Sometimes those, I think, especially in our culture, we tend to not like the struggle. But actually, the struggle shows us we're right on that edge. We're right on that place of learning, and to actually delight in that sense of, well, I don't know, this doesn't make any sense. It's like that koan, that riddle, that whole, in some ways, the more elusive it is, the more potential for understanding, a potential for shifting our perspective is embedded in that. So, you know, I encourage you to enjoy the struggle and use that question, what is here if nothing is added? And what has to happen if I don't add anything to it? Do I have to, because you're asking yourself to be unemployed. You're asking yourself to shift from a very different way of being. So thank you for sharing that, Suzanne.
Thank you.
All right, anyone else?
I have something quickly beautifully to say, and it's just the allure of enchantment, because I got caught in a memory and I just loved it in the first questioning time, and I wanted to stay there, and I just felt it was really a powerful draw. It was a memory from childhood and my mother, and so I wanted to stay there. And so then when we switched to the new question and there's nothing added, and I was thinking, oh, I missed that enchantment.
Yes.
So I really saw the contrast in the just the pure moment, as pure as it can be, and having to let go of that story that I really wanted to stay in for a while.
Yeah, that's a real honest, you know, reflection, is that sometimes the story is very delightful and alluring and very pleasant. It just has this quality. And you know, sometimes I reflect, okay, what keeps this whole mechanism going, the sense of wanting, or another way of saying it, what's the payoff? And often is that sense of pleasure, that sense of delight. And you know, yet though, it's like we're relating to life through our minds, through our story. And we don't always get a choice of what story is going to be playing.
Yes.
If we can always just have pleasant stories in our mind, then hey, we wouldn't be talking here. But we all know that sometimes the story that's running through us, the sense of self we've birthed into, is very painful. It's very, you know, it touches some of the most tender aspects of ourselves and our sense of interpersonal conflict. All these qualities are embedded in that relationship to story, into relationship to thought, and really into the relationship of self. And so we start to weigh that. You know, at some point in our practice, there's this weighing of, okay, there's these pleasurable moments of thought, you know, weighing that with the painful moments of thought. And then a third weighing is that sense of deep peace, that deep sense of ease that we can experience as Iris was talking about, that sense of deep stillness as Katie and Kate were talking about, that sense of, when I'm not doing anything with, there's a different quality of joy that is arising, a different quality of peace that's not dependent upon whatever is going through my mind. And it's something that, you know, we have to, you know, develop in some ways it's an acquired taste, but also it's much more of the deep fulfillment that it's really anything our minds think pales in comparison. And eventually our minds start to actually prefer that sense of stillness, that sense of not being engaged in the fantasy. All right, thank you, Lauren.
Thank you.
All right, perhaps have time for one more question or comment if there's one out there.
I could add something, Tim.
Yeah, sure.
The second question of Lauren was saying about that sense of wonder. Is that what you were saying about that sense of wonder? Somebody was saying about a sense of wonder. And during the other question, but when there's nothing added and you just look at a beautiful flower or whatever and you don't have a name for it, it's just there, there's a huge sense of wonder. But how do you actually express that without adding something to it? That was my dilemma. But I just had this sense that there's this sense of just glorious wonder out there, you know, all around me that I don't normally see because I'm adding something to it. But if I'm able to drop that, then the wonder is there, that wonderment. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. That sense of story or even the sense of label becomes this sense of separation, sense of insulation between us and the experience. Mm-hmm. It's like once we provide a label into it, our mind says, okay, I don't have to keep paying attention to it. I don't have to keep attending to it. But when we have that place of wonder, that sense of not knowing mind, we're engaged, we're fully present with it. And that, you know, that's the other element of your comment was, what was it? Yeah, something, it slipped away from my mind, but.
It slipped away from mine too.
Tim, yes. I think Cheryl said, if you don't add something and you're in wonder with something, how do you express it?
Oh, and yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, you don't have to express it, right? There's no need for expression.
Yeah.
So the sense of expressing, in certainly in one way, you're right, Iris, there's not a need to express. Just being with it is enough. And yet, you know, as humans, I mean, we look at the world of art and of music. It's all of expression of the beauty of what we encounter, what our openness to the moment leads to this expression of art. And so it's like there's a famous saying in Zen that, you know, there's the finger that's pointing toward the moon. You know? And so that's what art does. That's what the word does. That's what the articulate description of the beauty does. But we don't confuse the finger for it, the thing itself. We don't confuse the finger for the moon. And of course, sometimes our descriptions become their own thing, their own beauty. So it's we kind of go back and forth between the relative and absolute. There's this understanding of the relative nature that when that sense of self falls away, and there's just the deep intimacy with life. And we also live in the relative world of being able to say, this is a camellia or a rhododendron, or this is this kind of a flower, or this is kind of the sound of this bird. And we become more and more fluid to be go back and forth between the absolute and the relative without conflict, with ease. All right, thank you for all your questions. I appreciate your engagement with this you know, sometimes obtuse topic of dependent origination, but hopefully I can tell by your questions it's becoming more and more real in your experience. So next week we'll have another talk, probably on contact, but I might start to bring in the next topic of feeling tone, which will be even more concrete for us as we move into this quality of our reactivity. I just haven't decided yet. All right, so I hope you all have a wonderful week, and we'll explore this next time. All right, be well, and I'll unmute everyone, so if you'd like to say goodbye.